This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, former astronaut and U.S. Senator John Glenn died yesterday at the age of 95. We'll discuss that and other Ohio stories later in the show. Joining us first with a review of local news of the week, investigative reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, James Pilcher, and WVXU City Hall reporter, Jay Hanselman. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And James and Jay, good to see both of you this afternoon. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the streetcar. The streetcar got off to such a strong start, Jay, back in September. But if you start looking at the overall ridership numbers, there's something going on here. So tell us about the numbers that are showing up lately.
Well, this all came to light during council has a major transportation committee that's in charge of the streetcar. And really, it was a tale of two reports. And the either supporters were tweeting one set of numbers, and those who are maybe not so supportive were talking about another set of numbers. So the number that impresses supporters was through the end of October, through October 31st, there were 228,609 streetcar rides.
So that's total ridership
That's for the first 2 months, okay, the end of October. And that was just about 80,000 more than what officials had estimated.
Okay.
So that was some of the tweets that you saw, you know, it's 80,000 to the good. But then when we got the other presentation, actually from SORTA, which is managing the operating the streetcar on a contract with the city, the ridership numbers for November, there were only about 50,000 rides, and the estimate that they were working with was 86,000, and so that was about a 60% reduction in what had been expected. So through October, things were doing pretty good. November, the numbers have really started to go downhill. And as you said off there when we were talking about it, if you look at it on a graph, it really is strong September. It's a downward trend,
yeah.
Particularly on the weekdays.
Overall, ridership is below expectations or projections by 45% since the beginning for the first 3 months total. So, you know, let's raise a lot of eyebrows down in City Hall. Yeah.
And the reason that's important is because the streetcar budget is based on X number, I think it's 3,000 riders per day to meet the operating budget. And through, I think, if I'd opened this up, I think for November, the average dropped to 1,664. So that's just about half of what had been projected.
So do they have any ideas what's causing this? I mean, what problems is this linked to?
So I think there's a couple of things that supporters are pointing to. One, they're saying, is the reliability of timing of when it's arriving at the stations. Right now, it is not meeting its headways. In the peak times, there's supposed to be a streetcar rolling by a stop every 12 to 15 minutes. That's lagged somewhat. Non-peak, it's supposed to be 15 minutes.
And when we're talking headways, you're talking about the time between stops, right?
Right. Okay. If you're standing there, you shouldn't have to wait any longer than 15 minutes for a streetcar. And again, they're pointing to the reliability. And then also, I think, and that's why they want to do supporters want to do a traffic study. The streetcar is being held up at an awful lot of red lights along the route. And I think probably in hindsight, the officials probably should have maybe done the study before. They didn't. But the traffic in downtown Cincinnati is geared east to west, and the streetcar runs largely north to south.
So they thought that wouldn't be a problem, I guess.
I think they probably thought it was going to be a problem, but I don't think at that time they had the money and a way to pay for a study to find out.
Well, and the other thing that we've seen, and I know that my colleague Dan Horn did a story on this a couple of weeks ago, is that we've seen that maybe impacting those reliability studies, is there been a series of accidents, more accidents, you know, not necessarily the streetcar driver's fault, but people are still learning how to drive in and around the tracks and the route. And so there have been several collisions which have shut down the lines and made that reliability issue even greater.
And that was something that they pointed out during the month of November. There were 44 times the streetcar had to stop operating because of some sort of blockage. Now, that could be as simple as a car blocking the tracks. And when a car blocks the tracks, you know, they can't operate until it is off the tracks. And SORTA admits that that can be anywhere from a 15 to maybe an hour or more, depending on how long it takes to get that vehicle so it's not blocking the tracks.
Did they talk about the two-step process for the tickets, Jay? Was that something that raised any concerns?
Actually, that's been, for the most part, eliminated. In the beginning, when you bought your fare pass at one of the vending machines, you got the pass out of the machine, but then you immediately had to put it in like a validation slot, and they switched that now. So when you buy the ticket, when you buy the pass, it comes out pre-validated, so you don't have to go to the extra step of validating the pass anymore.
I remember when you and I talked when they first got the streetcar running that two-step process was just causing a lot of confusion with people.
And apparently they are now beginning to do some fare inspections, and I think the number was 70% of the people originally were doing it correctly, and 70% were paying correctly. The other 30% were not paying or had paid but had failed to validate. Now that they've got the automatic validation when you buy the ticket, they're expecting that number to drop. And I think as of Tuesday, they had issued three $100 citations for people who were riding the streetcar without paying.
I know that my colleague Jason Williams did a good column looking at the political ramifications of this. Obviously, we have the incumbent John Cranley, who ran as an anti-streetcar candidate. He has, he has sort of lukewarmly embraced the streetcar now that it's reality. But his opponent in the Democratic primary will be Yvette Simpson, who was very strong for the streetcar. And so now that the streetcar is, you know, stumbling out of the gate, as some people say, it's going to be interesting to see how that issue plays, you know, how Ms. Simpson can spin it to say, hey, this is a long-term project, as the supporters say. The supporters say that, yeah, we might not get the numbers right away, but this is also an economic development tool. Look at all the buildings that are going up along the routes and all that stuff. So she can play to that, whereas Cranley might be able to say, hey, you were behind the streetcar and it's turned out to be not as good as we thought. So that's going to be an interesting thing to watch going forward.
Yeah. There were so many debates and so many arguments about the streetcar when it was in the planning stages and before it became reality. And then it seemed like it got quiet for a little while, Jay. But you think that this is going to renew the debating and the arguing over the streetcar at City Hall?
I would somehow say that for infinity, somehow – the streetcar is always going to be a debate. And I know there are some who thought that the streetcar would not be an issue in the 2017 mayor's race. I don't see any way that it's not. It may not be as big an issue as it was in the 2013 race, but it's still going to be there.
What about the idea that we keep hearing talk about expanding the streetcar system? Has there been any talk about the slump hurting plans for expansion?
I think it's too early to say that. I mean, the supporters still say that it needs to go up the hill to the uptown area. And quite frankly, I think that's all going to kind of be on hold and talking points until after 2017. And my personal hunch is that if John Cranley is reelected mayor in 2017, you don't have to worry anything about any talk of the streetcar going up the hill until after Cranley's no longer in office.
There have been some discussions and preliminary looks at doing a preliminary study of bringing it into Kentucky. But that would create other issues as to which bridges could handle it and everything else. But I know that we've written a couple of stories looking at the feasibility of that, and that there are some officials over there looking very hard at how well it does in Cincinnati and to see if that's something they want to tie into.
And back up the hill, I know John Schneider is one of the major supporters of the streetcar project. He's not convinced that the alignment that they've been talking about going up Vine Street, I think,
right,
is the best way to get to the uptown area. So that's even open for debate.
Yeah, because that would create a whole bunch of logistical issues, you know, the curve and all of those things on Vine Street as well.
And I think there's a major electrical facility that Duke would have to relocate that could even be more expensive than the utilities they had to relocate for the original 3.6 miles downtown and over the Rhine.
You were talking earlier, Jay, about improving the headway, the time between the stations. How are they going to accomplish that?
Well, that's a good question. Mayor Cranley this week, he says that Transdev, who has a contract with SORTA to actually do the actual running of the streetcars, is contractually obligated to meet those 12 to 15-minute headways. And basically, he said at the end of this week's council meeting that if Transdev can't meet those contractual mandates, then perhaps the city needs to take Transdev to court and make it perform on that contract. interestingly, after that meeting, council member Yvette Simpson was talking with me in the hallway, and she said, you know, look, we could put all five streetcars on the tracks, and they're all going to get stuck on Walnut Street because of the signal issue. So, you know, even you could put all five streetcars out on the route, so to speak, and you could still have problems with the headways because of the traffic tie-ups.
Let's roll to another topic while we're at this.
Well, that way we can stay on track.
Yeah. There you go, Jay. I was expecting a pun at some point. Cincinnati, it's 6 months away from its next budget, but already there's talk that there could be a shortfall.
It's kind of a strange setup. Even though council won't vote on the operating budget until June, they actually have to have what is called a tentative tax budget to the county auditor by January the 20th. And so the city manager released his proposed tentative tax budget on Wednesday, and he is projecting that the budget that he's put together, that there could be a $7.1 million deficit, and he's attributing most of that to the large raises that were given to all of the city's employees earlier this year, both represented and non-represented. Now, for the manager to get a deficit of $7.1 million, he's basing that on city council increasing the city's general fund property tax revenue to the maximum that's allowed in the city charter, which is 6.1 mils. Council hasn't done that since 2000, when they began rolling back the tax millage rate to make the amount that they collect each year steady. And Mayor Cranley has already introduced his own proposed tentative tax budget, which holds that amount at about, I think it's like $28.9 million. Now, if that's the case, then the city's deficit actually gets closer to $9 million next year. As a point of reference, though, when this all happened a year ago, I think the budget deficit then was about $13 million. So it's actually a little bit less, but there is a deficit. But it's not as large as some they've dealt with in the past.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when Cranley came into office, he was dealing with a $30 million budget deficit. A lot of that was erased by the pension deal. They were having to throw so much money into that pension hole, and that's gone. You know, the other issue that at least Black is saying, they still don't have the official economic forecast from UC that they rely on to do this budget, but they are forecasting a significant drop in tax revenues. You know, there's a lot of talk potentially of a recession next year. There are some economic headwinds that are headed this way, so that's part of what may be going on in terms of their tentative planning. But they could wind up, and this has happened before too, where they'll say, you know, we budgeted for this kind of tax situation, and then the taxes come in higher than what they anticipate, so they actually wind up with a surplus. So it's all kind of a guessing game at this point.
Right. The key word is this is a projected deficit.
And one thing that is interesting, that things are a little bit tighter. We're 4 months into the city's budget, July, August, September, and October, that they've reported on. And I think through the end of October, revenues were ahead $152,000. For reference, a year ago, that was closer to $2 million. So things have tightened up.
So what's next on this, Jay, as far as the property tax rate?
They have to have a public hearing, which is scheduled for December the 19th. And then once they have that public hearing, then they can vote to submit this budget to the county auditor. My guess is Cranley has the proposal that will hold it flat at $28.9 million. That's been the policy since 2000. In an election year,
there's not going to be a member of council is going to vote for a tax increase.
There might be one or two,
yeah.
But they'll
know that they're going to get defeated anyway. So.
Right, and in theory, in order for it to go up, it would have to have six votes, because if it were five votes, Cranley would likely veto it. So they have to have six if they're going to increase it, and I just don't see that happening.
Well, Jay, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
No problem.
WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman, and we will continue our review of local news with the Inquirer's James Pilcher. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
My name is Sasha Kemet, and I listen to NPR. Public radio is unique because the questions that the interviewers ask tend to show a little more insight and depth into the issues and the relevant topics in the news. I use what I hear on NPR in everyday conversation and talking about politics and talking about current events. And I always have a story for somebody. Oh, did you hear the story about X, Y, or Z? You should really go listen to it. You'd enjoy it. I support public radio, and I hope that you do too.
Here's your chance to make your tax-deductible year-end gift to WVXU or WMUB. Make that phone call to 513-419-7155. You can also give online at WVXU.org or WMUB.org. And thank you so much for your support. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. And joining me this afternoon, investigative reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, James Pilcher. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. James, you had an article about a recent investigation that you did into high-speed pursuits by Cincinnati police.
Actually, statewide as well.
And this was all spurred by some analysis that USA Today did about high-speed chases. Fill us in on this.
Well, USA Today did looked at high-speed or any what they considered crash. The USA Today data was specifically about fatal crashes that were as a result.
A result of a high-speed chase.
Of a police chase of some sort.
Okay.
So they looked at those statewide, and USA Today more looked at the racial breakdown of that. And what the national figure found was that black motorists or even bystanders were the rate of death, the rate of fatalities was three times as high for blacks as it was for whites that were involved in these chases. You know, so locally, we found that data, and we found, well, how many chases have there been here locally? We broke it down. Ohio actually, you know, it made sense given the size of the population, but Ohio ranked seventh in total number of fatalities during the period that was covered.
Ohio is what, about seventh or ninth in population?
It's in the top 10 population wide. So the other thing we did look at statewide was the racial breakdown. By the state, and we found that the percent of black fatalities was 33% of the total fatalities, which also was very high, compared to other states. But the thing that experts talked about in that is that most of the fatalities occurred, and most of the chases occurred in the urban areas in the state. Cincinnati, Dayton, Columbus, Cleveland accounted for more than half of the total. So that, the higher black population meant higher fatalities and those kinds of things. Locally, we saw a marked increase in the number of police chases. I won't put the word high speed in there because Cincinnati has broadened what they call a chase. I mean, they might be chasing somebody down the street, aka the way they chased O.J. Simpson down the highway at 40 miles an hour. You wouldn't call that a high speed. They tightened their policies back in 2014 in terms of what they consider a chase and how they can chase. They really, really don't. They really discourage or forbid anybody going 20 miles an hour over speed limit unless it's extreme circumstances.
So part of the reason for the increase could be just they've redefined the term.
Exactly. Okay. So that was one of the reasons that they gave me is that, for the increase. And they also said that, while it did increase to, let's say, 100 last year, back in 2003, they had more than 200. So they've really changed their policies locally. That being said, there were three or four that I dove into, including that myself and a colleague, Keith Bieri-Golick, dove into that really raised some questions. One was up in Butler County. One was by the CPD, and then the other was by the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office. Two involved black suspects fleeing. One was the third one, but the CPD suspect was black, I don't think, but he crashed into the rear end of a taxi cab, killing both people in the taxi. And there was some questions about whether or not how the officers involved instigated that chase, and they were going 80 miles an hour downtown over by the casino. So there was some question about that. But that's in general what we found.
What kind of reaction have you gotten to the story?
I've gotten everything from there were people within the Black Lives Matter community saying, well, that's because they're pulling us over too much. And that, some people do snap, and there are suspects who are driving away when they shouldn't, whatever. But one of the things that we need to look at is that you know, look at how much blacks are being pulled over versus white motorists and where they're being pulled over and that kind of thing. And then there was the then, like I said, the police reacted saying, you know, not all of these are high speed chases. You need to look deeper at in terms of the speed we reached and everything else. One thing that I did mention in the story was that Ohio Attorney General and soon-to-be governor candidate Mike DeWine has launched a task force to take a look at statewide policies and recommendations that they can issue to better give departments ranging from the size of Cincinnati urbans to some of these small rural law enforcement agencies guidelines on when to instigate a high-speed chase. How fast do you go? Do you have a trail car? Do you run red lights? Do you go down one-way streets? All of those things. And how do you keep in radio contact? Who keeps in radio contact? Because a lot of times the driver of a car has no time if he's doing 85, 100 miles an hour. And most officers I talk to say they do not want to do that. You get in this adrenaline rush and you don't want to take your eyes off the road. You have somebody else that's in a trail car perhaps radioing the situation. So there's all of those things are in play.
So but all this is still early stages.
There have been two or three meetings of this task force. I went to one of them, and they really get down into the weeds on this stuff.
You also did an update on the investigative stories that you did about asset seizures, forfeitures by law enforcement. First off, it kind of explained the background for why you started looking into this.
Ran the arc because this latest story was where I started. I got the tip that this kid who or college student originally from Cincinnati living in Florida was flying back. He had $11,000 in cash taken from him. The reason it was taken from him primarily was he admits he smoked some marijuana on the way to the airport. His bag smelled like pot. He smelled like pot. And the officers used that as justification. And these officers were deputized federal agents, local police officers acting as federal agents, using federal law, saying, hey, we suspect you of drug dealing activity, and by right, we can take this money from you. And we're going to try and seize it, and we're going to try and forfeit it and try to keep it.
Was he arrested? Was he charged ever?
He was never charged. He was arrested for resisting arrest because he put up a stink saying he can't take my money. They dropped those charges. So he never faced any charges on criminal charges.
Never found any marijuana in his luggage or anything like that?
Nope.
Okay.
They said, and I looked through the court filings, they said they found some pictures on his cell phone that might have indicated a pot, that might have indicated he was trying to make a deal, but they never brought any federal criminal charges or any local criminal charges. So this $11,000, which he said he got from his mother's military retirement fund he was going to use to pay for his college tuition. So his case got brought up by a nonprofit legal organization out of Washington, and this is probably the only way he would have ever done this. So he fought through the federal system, basically sued the federal government to get his money back. He had to fight in court. He had this pro bono agency getting it back, and just last month the federal judge they settled. The government said, okay, we'll give you your money back with interest. And they dropped the case.
I remember when you and I talked about this initially several months ago, mm-hmm. that you had talked about how difficult it is for people to get their money back.
It is.
Cases.
It's incredibly arduous. And if you hired a lawyer and paid them, you'd eat up any money you'd get back in legal fees. It's that complicated. In some of these cases, you know, obviously can involve a heck of a lot more than $11,000. But, you know, I've talked to people who've lost $15,000, $20,000 in cash that they might be carrying for business reasons. So this all plays into – and then I went further and said, okay, well, how much of these agencies that are involved in this federal task force made? And there are like 17 – don't quote me on the number – in the teens number of agencies that work CVG Drug Force for the Drug Enforcement Administration. And they made over $32 million in these seizures over the last 6 years. Overall, nationally, these agencies and the federal government have taken billions of dollars and been able to keep it. So that was my investigation into how much money they're making. This led to some questions in terms of state law. There are new efforts to reform criminal justice laws all over the countries and states and so forth, funded by both like civil rights groups like the ACLU and even black ministers, all the way to the Koch brothers on the conservative side. And they've created these task force trying to reform. So one of the things they've done is gone in at the state level. And we just saw yesterday the most recent case of this, where the Ohio Senate passed a bill that will probably go into law that now requires, if they're going to take your money on a state basis, using state law, not federal law, you have to be convicted of a crime. They can't just keep your money on suspicion you might have committed a crime like they can do in the federal law. And I know that there are some in Congress, and they're lobbying Congress hard to change that law in Congress to keep it from just being civil forfeiture, where they can keep it based on suspicion. Now, law enforcement questions this, and they say you're taking a tool out of our toolbox, and we will use that to shut down drug networks, and especially when you're dealing with hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in cash. But there are also the civil libertarians saying, hey, we shouldn't be doing this.
513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk to Marshawn. Hi, Marshawn.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Go right ahead.
Hey, back in the 70s, John Ehrlichman, the aide to President Nixon, was involved in, and also President Nixon, I guess that would have been Ford, as well as Carter and Reagan, were instrumental in bringing drugs directly to the black neighborhoods, and then making the activity of possession and distribution illegal, therefore, intentionally incarcerating black men. What I would like to know from your guest is, is any of that type of information, of this intentional use of the government behavior, been applied to these chases? Because obviously you got people who may or may not be doing something wrong in these neighborhoods, but they're being intentionally, these behaviors are intentionally stimulated by the behavior that the government has involved itself in.
Okay.
Well, I didn't dive into, like, in Cincinnati's case.
The whole issue of targeting, right?
I didn't dive into, the racial profiling angle of it too much in my investigation. I didn't look case by case. I can say that the case that I looked at for the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office involves someone who was African-American who they couldn't tell it was African-American because he had window tint. And he was originally pulled over on a window tint violation. His windows were too dark. And then he took off. So, you know, I don't know whether it's they're looking for a particular kind of car or if they're looking for whatever. But I don't feel qualified to make that corollary between the number of deaths and the number of and whether or not they're actually – if there's any intent there. The numbers are certainly there that more blacks die by percentage in police chases than whites do by percentage, but and by rate, not by total. If you look at the total number, but if you look at rate compared to population and so forth, that the blacks are more likely to die than whites in a high-speed police chase.
So just to wrap up here James, where do you plan to go with both the seizure story and the pursuit story? Any possible follow up?
Well, I can tell you that the pursuit story actually played into a series of stories we've been doing in terms of for lack of a better word, looking at both police conduct, both at the CPD as well as the regional level. I've got another series of stories coming out looking at how fatal shootings are handled and investigated and how they're adjudicated here locally. The seizures, well, like I said, we've been watching on the state level. Kentucky, there was an effort. There was never a bill introduced, but there certainly is talk in Kentucky about tightening their state laws. I'll certainly be watching very closely. There are now major forces at play pushing this through different state level and congressional levels to try to tighten up and reform what law enforcement agencies can and can't do when it comes to this.
James, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Investigative reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, James Pilcher. Coming up, the passing of an American hero, John Glenn, and other news from around the state. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
I'm Sue Mooney, and I support public radio. We live in a rural area, and so it lets us know what's going on in other parts of the United States as well as the world. Talk radio is very big in our area, but they don't really give the variety and the balanced approach that NPR does. it offers such a wide variety. You know, it isn't just the news, it's the shows, it's the music. Even if you're living in a small area, it opens up the whole world to you. That's why I support it and why you should too.
It's been a busy year, and today we're trying to take the stress out of making your year-end charitable contributions. Hopefully WVXU is on the list of nonprofits you choose to support this year. Make that call to 513-419-7155, or you can give online at wvxu.org or wmub.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us now with a review of Ohio News of the Week, Cincinnati Inquirer Columbus Bureau Chief Chrissy Thompson, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Chrissy, Andy, and Howard, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Andy, let's start with, we're in a lame duck session of the Ohio legislature right now. A lot of activity going on. One of the things the Ohio House did recently was they passed the heartbeat bill. Tell us about that bill. What does it have in it?
Well, the heartbeat would ban an abortion once a vital heartbeat is detected in a fetus. And what happened was, we've been hearing about the heartbeat bill, its own separate standalone piece of legislation, for years now. What happened this year was that the Senate rolled the provisions of that bill into a different bill and as an amendment, and passed it through on Tuesday, and then it kind of just worked its way through both chambers very quickly, kind of in a surprise move. And again, this has been something that especially the House has been trying to get passed for years now. The Senate has been the chamber that has kind of stood up against it and said, no, we don't want this. We think that it would be struck down by the courts. We think it would be found unconstitutional, and therefore kind of setting back the pro-life movement in general. But they sang a different tune on Tuesday, and the bill finally passed through both chambers.
So the original thought was that they were going to attach this to the ban on abortions after 20 weeks, wasn't it? But they attached it to something else. Am I understanding right?
I don't know. You know, honestly, we just didn't expect to see this move at all. That certainly is would have been a possibility. It would have put even more pressure on John Kasich to pass or to sign the legislation. Right now, there's kind of some debate as to whether he will veto it. He has line item veto for the bill it's in because there's an appropriation of tax revenue. So, but anyway, even when we were looking at the legislative calendar a couple of weeks out before lame duck and looking at the bills that they have left to look at, we didn't have any indication that this was going to happen. And Keith Faber, the president of the Senate, who does have possible statewide ambitions, I think it should be noted, but he said when they amended this bill in and passed it, he said there's a new president and there will be new Supreme Court justices, and so we're going to go for it, basically. They seem to be empowered by Trump's election.
Chrissy, wasn't one of the arguments over this too that it didn't make exceptions for a woman's life or health?
I think there actually is an exception.
There
for
is an exception
for
okay,
woman's
so
life, but
it was
not rape and
not
incest.
Rape or incest. Okay, so that was one of the arguments that centered on the whole passage of this bill.
That's the big argument that House and Senate Democrats have been pushing lately, is that I think that they know that if they want to stop a bill, they're not going to be able to stop the overall argument of banning these abortions because the House and Senate have a strong majority of Republicans in it. And so they've been really focusing on the rape and incest provision, trying to at least still allow for abortions in those cases. And we heard a lot of heartfelt testimony on both floors when it came to that. But ultimately, in the end, those, as far as rape and incest is concerned, that is still, that does not play a factor.
Do you get an impression of where Kasich is going to go on this? Well, he's publicly opposed the bill in the past. His main reason in the past has been that it's unconstitutional, according to the current standard. So the current standard is that states can't limit abortions before the point where the fetus reaches viability, which is generally accepted at 24 weeks right now. So he has... He and many other abortion opponents have always said, we shouldn't just send something that's going to be struck down right away, or that could put at risk some of our other abortion restrictions. I think that this point we've been talking about, the lack of exception for rape or incest, that's something that Kasich feels pretty strongly about. So that could be one of the things he's considering. Usually when they veto, they put a memo out that says why, and that's something he certainly could use. Yeah.
And so the fact that the House and Senate also passed the 20-week ban, that kind of gives the governor a little bit of political cover as well. So if he were to line item veto the provisions of the heartbeat bill, then he could still fall back on the 20-week ban.
So they're concerned.
And I think it's just a real quick thing. It's important to note that you're right, and I think Chrissy kind of mentioned this, that there was just a slight whisper of the idea of putting the heartbeat bill into the 20-week ban, but instead they put it into a different bill that had an appropriation that gives the governor an opportunity to line item veto the heartbeat bill out instead of just vetoing an entire bill.
It's almost as if they're saying, you do the dirty work for us.
Yeah.
If he does sign it, Andy and Chrissy, how likely is this going to be challenged in court?
Certainly, it's
going to be challenged.
Yes. Within hours
it's
not going to take any time at all before this ends up. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've seen the headlines. It would make Ohio. Ohio would have the strictest bans on abortions in the country if this were to go through.
And this has already been struck down in North Dakota and Arkansas. The Supreme Court, I believe, has declined to hear it. I think that's how far it made. I may be getting that confused with one other bill this specific group has supported, but it takes several years for something to make it up to the Supreme Court, and they're saying this group of abortion opponents that supports this bill, they are saying that they hope that, for instance, Ruth Bader Ginsburg might not be on the court by the time it gets there, and so there would be an advantage for conservatives at that point, and that this bill perhaps would be found constitutional with a new court. So I think it's important to remember, though, that if it does go into effect, become law, it won't go into effect because there would be this court challenge, and almost certainly the court would kind of put an injunction on the law so it wouldn't take effect until all the court battles were over.
Right. But Chrissy, at this point, we're not even sure if Governor Kasich is going to sign either one of these bills, right?
No, we don't. We don't have any indication. I think there's a good chance he'll sign the 20-week ban. His allies at Ohio Right to Life, this is their handpicked legislation. He does oppose abortion, so this is kind of the approach that he has endorsed in the past. It's going to be a tough one on the heartbeat bill.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what he'll do.
I don't think I agree. It won't play out great for the governor, but it's almost like it's the governor's turn to come out and state that he's somewhat against the heartbeat bill. The House has kind of had to be put in that position once before where they voted it down. The Senate has had to not act on the heartbeat bill for a couple of sessions now. And it almost feels like, okay, Governor Kasich, now it's your turn to come out publicly and have to be against it for whatever reason you want to make. But now it's your turn to be against it.
Moving on to something else, Andy, the Ohio legislature is also looking at a bill that would allow concealed carry on college campuses. In fact, I think it's just it's expanding the areas where concealed carry would be allowed. Where does this particular bill stand right now? What's the status on it?
This bill has passed out of the House and Senate. It was one of those late night bills that we stayed here at the State House until 3 o'clock in the morning to watch. But that bill is now heading to the governor's desk. And you're right, there are in state law a list of places that are automatically banned for people who want to carry concealed. college campuses are one, daycares are another. And so what this bill does is it takes those places off of this automatic ban list. That doesn't mean that college campuses or universities, they can still decide to have concealed carry ban laws. But now, so let's say Ohio State University, the Board of Trustees at the Ohio State University will have to make that rule themselves, which they have. So concealed carry can still be banned on a college campus if that college wants to ban it or if a daycare wants to ban it.
So it's no longer automatic. Okay.
Right. This just eliminates the barrier of state law.
And then the argument against that, because supporters of the bill say, well, this gives local control. But the argument against that is, well, the state law just gave a little bit more legal cover for these groups and for these businesses so that they wouldn't have to make those decisions and that it would they would have just the protection of statute from the state.
So, but Andy, why do supporters say that it's even necessary in the first place to expand concealed carry?
Well, of course, this is a bill that the NRA supports strongly, all the gun lobbyists support strongly. And so if you are a representative or a senator who wants to support those types of issues, that's one reason why you would be for it. But the ideology behind it is that if there is some sort of threat, let's say a college campus, if there is a threat and college campuses ban concealed carry, who would be the quote-unquote good guy with a gun who could neutralize that threat? Let's take the example of OSU, the attack on OSU's campus. OSU has law enforcement. They have armed police to take care of that situation, whereas a small community college in a rural area, the nearest law enforcement might be 20 minutes away if an attack were to happen. And so what lawmakers are saying, let's let trained concealed carriers be able to carry concealed onto campus, and that good guy with a gun could protect the people around them in the event of an attack.
And what are opponents saying?
Well, I mean, Chrissy, the thing is that if anytime you add guns to a situation, there are a lot of people who say anytime you add guns to a situation,
it could create more confusion for law enforcement.
You're creating more danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
A lot of OSU students who experienced that knife and vehicle attack on campus came to the state house to protest and to testify against this bill, saying that if there were students carrying concealed weapons during that situation, they say it would have made it so much worse. There would have caused a lot of confusion. The police officers who were on the scene wouldn't know who the good guy was, who the bad guy was in that scenario.
So what's next for this bill?
Let's headed to Kasich's desk.
Okay.
All of these bills, once they get to Kasich's desk, he has 10 days to decide what to do with them. He can veto them, sign them, or do nothing, in which case they automatically become law. But sometimes it takes like a week or even two for the desk to clear, especially at the very end when they're passing a ton of stuff all the time. There's a lot of technicalities that they have to get done before they send it over to Kasich. So time frame wise, I think this will become law. I don't know if he'll sign it, but I think it will become law. It's just Chrissy Thompson's opinion, but
okay.
I'm a very smart person, so no.
I agree with Chrissy Thompson's opinion.
Chrissy, you're good at predicting things.
I think he'll just let it become law.
Yeah. Chrissy, something else that happened this week, too. The Ohio lawmakers passed a bill that says cities cannot set a minimum wage higher than the state's rate, which is $8.15 an hour. So why did they pass this bill? What's behind this?
Well, the most immediate reason is that there is an effort in Cleveland underway to raise the minimum wage to $15. We've heard about that in Cincinnati as well. They're not quite as far along in Cincinnati. I believe they actually completed all the petitions and such to get it on the ballot in Cleveland. So that's why city officials in Cleveland specifically asked for this bill, saying that they basically didn't have enough money for this kind of a thing. It would hurt the economy, yada, yada, yada. Republicans are of the mind that states should be able to set that themselves and raise it incrementally instead of by by such a large margin, which they say the market does not dictate. So Republicans control the state house, and it passed.
And so any group that wants to raise the minimum wage in the state of Ohio is going to have to take a different approach. I guess they'd have to approach it as a constitutional amendment if they want to achieve this?
A statewide referendum type of a thing. Yeah, you can do either a citizen-initiated statute, which is a bill, or a constitutional amendment.
And which is very hard and very expensive.
Yeah. A lot more signatures required for that, and then to actually, the biggest expense is to actually compete to try to get this passed on the ballot. You have to run ads in all of our media markets. We're a really expensive state.
And Howard, former astronaut, U.S. Senator from Ohio, John Glenn, he died yesterday at the age of 95. And Glenn's remembered by many of us for his service to the country in the military, as an astronaut, and in politics. Now, you knew him for a long time, actually. What, about 40-some-odd years?
42 years.
Wow. What are your remembrances of John Glenn?
Well, John Glenn is a unique individual in Ohio political history and also in American history. I mean, he is a man of accomplishments that are unbelievable. Even if he had never flown on that flight in February of 1962, the Friendship 7 orbiting the Earth, he would have had a great career. He was a fighter pilot in both World War II and the Korean War. He obviously was the first American to orbit the Earth.
And we can't stress how crucial that was, because at the time, the Russians were so far ahead in the space race.
They were so far ahead of the U.S. in the space race, and there was a very great concern about the U.S. couldn't compete in the race, and the race was to get to the moon. And John Glenn, I talked to him about it many times. You know, he said this was real. I mean, this was a real fear that we had, and it was what motivated us as the seven original Mercury astronauts and the people at NASA was to catch up to the Russians and overpass them. And he said that, you know, he was proud of the fact that he was able to help the country do that.
He had just a remarkable political career, though, as well.
Yeah, he did. Obviously, 1970, he ran in a Democratic primary against Howard Metzenbaum and lost. Came back 4 years later and won the Democratic nomination, and ran against Ralph Perk and was elected to serve four terms in the U.S. Senate. And nobody could touch him. I mean, he was just, you know, every 6 years it was automatic that he would be reelected. Until in 1997, I went to the event that he held at Muskegon College in his hometown of New Concord, Ohio, and announced that he wasn't going to run again in 1998. And he said, you know, that birthdays were catching up with you. There was no cure for the common birthday, is what he said. But then, the very next year...
Surprise.
In 1998, he became, at the age of 77, a specialist on a flight of the space shuttle Discovery.
Just amazing.
It was just absolutely amazing.
Yes.
Where he spent 9 days in space. And he had only spent 6 hours in space on the Mercury flight. And people were just, it was fascinating. You know, he did a press conference from the space shuttle.
I remember that. I was like 12 years old, I think, then, but I was just fascinated. It's just amazing history.
He's had an impact on so many lives.
Yeah,
a remarkable man.
I mean, he was one of those guys. He was one of my heroes as a little boy. I mean, I was 9 years old when he flew in the Mercury flight, and I met him when I was at Ohio University as a reporter for the student newspaper there. And I was so scared. I mean, I was just scared to death because this was like this
famous American hero.
Yes. I'm sitting there and I'm talking to him, and he made me feel at ease. He answered every question. He was as kind and gracious as could possibly be. And that was the key to the man. I mean, I have never seen, I've covered thousands of people in politics, but, you know, that was the key to him, that he never forgot where he came from.
Exceptional man. Yes.
Very, very much so.
Well, Chrissy, Andy, and Howard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Cincinnati Inquirer Columbus Bureau Chief Chrissy Thompson, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeyer was the producer for today's show, Belinda Kai was the assistant producer, and Dave Shermer was the technical director. Atlas Obscura is an online resource for explorers of the curious and unusual. The site includes information on 10,000 unique places and events found around the world. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll talk with one of the founders of Atlas Obscura. We'll also look at this season's top high-tech gifts. And in Focus on Technology, how four Lakota East students plan to cure AIDS. That's Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.